Hello and welcome to Northwestern Exposure, a weekly look at whole systems approaches to issues affecting individuals and communities in the industrial world. I'm Paul Nelson. Today, the first of two programs recorded at the 29th Annual Port Townsend Writers Conference. The conference is produced annually by Centrum and is masterminded by poet, translator, and founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, Sam Hamill. Copper Canyon is perhaps the premier nonprofit literary press with a strong commitment to translation, which Sam says is much more significant than it might seem.
Our lives are really shaped by translation. Most Americans are, Christian or Jewish, and they read the Bible, but very few of them read it in the original language. People who study Islam, very few people really study the original language. So from our philosophy, Plato and Socrates, from our religions, all of this is a translated culture. What makes America great, in fact, is the fact that it is a translated culture.
An upcoming project of the press is the collected works of the poet who some feel is largely responsible for the culture of the West Coast. Sam says Kenneth Rexroth sounded like W.C. Fields and definitely had his motivation for writing poetry prioritized, as the following story indicates.
A nice little white-haired lady in the audience didn't understand why he was on a political tirade and stood up and said, "Mr. Rexroth, I just don't understand why you write poetry." "My dear, I write poetry to seduce women and overthrow the capitalist system, in that order."
The guiding light of Copper Canyon Press, Sam Hamill, talks about the press, the importance of translation, the legacy of Kenneth Rexroth, and other things in his inimitable, compassionate, cantankerous manner. I hope you enjoyed today's program. Thanks for tuning in.
I don't really need much of an excuse to spend a week or even a couple of days in Port Townsend, Washington's Victorian seaport, as the sign says. But when I found out that the Natural Marine Science History Camp was happening the same week as the Writers' Conference, it seemed like synchronicity for a father-daughter trip, and off we went. This conference is not just any Writers' Conference. It's the 29th annual Port Townsend Writers' Conference, produced by Copper Canyon Press for Centrum Arts and Creative Education. The director of the conference, founding editor, and spiritual center of Copper Canyon is Sam Hamill, a renowned poet, essayist, and translator who's published over a dozen volumes of original poetry. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You're a long way from Utah.
A long way. Been gone a long time.
Yeah, from Utah originally and left at
an
early age.
I was probably born in Northern California, but I kind of grew up in Utah, left as a teenager.
Yeah, I was through Moab recently, where you had been shortly before then.
My first visit to Moab in many, many years.
Yeah. You know what? Before we even get going, there's a poem about being an editor, I guess, that would be perfect to set this up. So would you be so kind as to read that?
Well, I'm about to turn 60, and of course, when you get that age, people start talking about retirement. So this is called On Being Asked About Retirement. It's from a new book of poems called Dumb Luck. For most white male Americans my age, it would be nothing special, I suppose, to drive an hour to a shopping mall and buy a summer's clothes. Year after year, I bought a pair of jeans and a couple of shirts from the discount rack to mark the beginning of summer. But suddenly I find myself being paid for doing just what I've always done, giving poetry away. Entering middle class at my age makes me, I admit it, nervous. Nevertheless, I like this Van Heusen, and that arrow is awfully nice. I've never owned a necktie or a suit, and I don't suppose I'm the least inclined to now. Put me in a suit and I'd be fake as a presidential smile. Same old jeans to greet my day. For an editor, the crap factor's deep some days. I'll buy myself some teeth and a sexy dress for my beautiful wife and celebrate with sake and unagi, and that's a change of life. It sounds a little odd to say it this way, but I'm employed in the service of poetry. I got a job at job security.
Those presidential smiles are getting more fake year after year, aren't they? That's only going to go better with age. Copper Canyon started as a Centrum project, I understand.
No, actually, I founded Copper Canyon Press in Denver in 1972 with several other people and brought it to Port Townsend in 1974.
Did a residency have something
we
to do
We became it? Centrum's first artist in residence.
Yeah. And the rest, I guess, is history. Some people say Copper Canyon is the nation's premier nonprofit literary press. Can you tell us about some of the artistic advantages of being a nonprofit press in an era of bottom-line transnational corporate thinking?
Well, we publish a good deal more poetry than any of the New York publishers, and we do a better job of selling it because we publish poetry exclusively. And our standards are set by the quality of the poetry, not by the marketplace. So some of our very best poets are, in some cases, some of the least known poets. In other cases, there are extremely well-known poets like Carolyn Kaiser or William Merwin, W.S. Merwin, certainly Hayden Carruth, who are internationally renowned poets. They're also on our list because they came to us because of our devotion to poetry first, last, and always. Poetry on the book list of New York publishers is at the bottom of the list. Poetry on our list is at the top, in the middle, and at the bottom.
Yeah, and obviously that gives you an advantage. So how does the typical capitalist thinking come into play? Does it at all?
Well, it does come to play. We have to be responsible to our donors. People give us money to help support poetry. If we don't spend that money wisely, they're certainly not going to continue to give it to us. So you have to give people a certain amount of bang for their buck. We have to publish wisely, even though we're not publishing under a red line only. So that if a book's going to be a mid-list seller and only sell 3,000 or 4,000 copies, we've got to be wise enough to be able to figure that out in advance so that we don't print 8,000 and end up destroying some. We've never destroyed books. We've never remaindered books and dumped them. We're really good at selling our product. So while we're not dominated by the marketplace, we have to play in the marketplace and play by the rules of the marketplace.
And yet also you have to be careful to print quality to have that consideration for your donors. And yet you often get to print friends. So I imagine that's a fine line you have to walk sometimes.
Well, it doesn't exactly work that way. I have a lot of literary friendships, but those friendships developed out of the literature, not out of a friendship first in virtually all of those cases. My closeness with Hayden Carruth became what it is because I work closely with him as his editor and his ally.
Yeah. What are some other examples?
Some
other examples, friends of yours that you ended up publishing?
Well, Richard Jones is a wonderful example. I guess about 20 years ago, I was down in the South, I think in North Carolina, and I heard him read at a poetry reading, and I walked up to him afterwards and introduced myself and said, I sure would like to have that manuscript. In some cases, there are things that have come totally blind. 30 years ago, an unknown Utah poet, Dave Lee, sent me a manuscript. It had some poems in it about being a pig farmer. And Dave and I had a discussion, and I suggested that there was a real rich mine here that ought to be worked, and there was some real gold in there. And he's become a renowned poet, telling sort of small-town country poems that are very narrative, where we published him before he'd published anywhere.
About 7 or 8 years ago, the press was in danger of going out of business, and now you're publishing more
books. That was a rumor. That wasn't really true. We had a change in staff, which forced us to put a few things back on the schedule a little bit. We were never in danger of closing. We have probably the strongest board of directors in nonprofit publishing. I was never concerned about going out of business.
But there was a struggle there.
Well, literary publishing is always a struggle, but we were never endangered.
The mission of Copper Canyon is to enhance, tell me if I have this right, to enhance the understanding, appreciation, and status of poetry in our culture and to build the audience for poetry. Now, why do you think poetry is in need of having organizations dedicated to bolstering its status?
Well, for the very reason that I sort of gave earlier, and that is that in commercial publishing, poetry is at the bottom of the list, and often what sells best is least important. It's very easy to sell postcard poetry or greeting card poetry, and it's very difficult to sell a real genius. So we're like any other arts organization. If you're going to have good galleries for your painters and sculptors, you're going to have people that are willing to support those galleries. And we are, in essence, a gallery for poetry, except that our primary function in the world is to print books.
A lot of people say that poetry has marginalized itself, and Victor Hernandez Cruz says it's not poetry that's marginalized itself, it's the culture that has done that.
Well, I perhaps would in part disagree with that. There are more poetry readings now than ever before in this country. More books of poetry in the marketplace, more books of poetry being bought, more poetry on the airways, more poetry in the workshops than ever before in our history. When I was a young teenager and a young beatnik poet, there were virtually no women poets, no Hispanic poets, two or three black poets, no Filipino poets, no Asian American poets, no Euro American poets. There were, you know, four poets, and they were all in the Academy. And there were no poetry readings until November 1956 at the Sixth Gallery, when Kenneth Rexroth and Mike McClure and Gary Snyder broke down, and Allen Ginsberg, of course, read Howl, and really brought poetry back to the people.
From the academies?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Before the Beat Movement, there were virtually no public readings anywhere in this country in the communities, and very few in the colleges.
It was very elitist.
It was.
Yeah. We're talking with Sam Hamill, the founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference, poet, translator, and essayist, who's published over a dozen volumes of original poetry, including Destination Zero, poems 1970 to 1995, Gratitude, and Dumb Luck. That poem that you read earlier, the title piece from Dumb Luck, is that?
That's from a new book that will be published in September.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about how well poetry is doing in this country. Let's talk about poetry in other countries, and that's part of where Copper Canyon has been headed in recent years. A lot of translations, a beautiful an anthology of contemporary Mexican poetry called Reversible Monuments, one example of that.
Well, that's the first really substantial anthology of contemporary Mexican poetry to have any breadth and depth in 40 or 50 years. Our dedication to translation, I guess, is pretty well known. But if you really stop and think about it, our lives are really shaped by translation. Most Americans are, you know, Christian or Jewish, and they read the Bible, but very few of them read it in the original language. People who study Islam, very few people really study the original language. So from our philosophy, you know, Plato and Socrates, from our religions, all of this is a translated culture. What makes America great, in fact, is the fact that it is a translated culture. Our sense of democracy is rooted in the Greek, Demokritos.
And also the Native American, the Iroquois.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And their own sense of democracy, which was so different from ours. And the languages that we destroyed, nearly 200 years of languages being annihilated in North America during a century of genocide, that has a cultural and aesthetic impact, as well as the basic gut impact that you feel when you really consider what that means to not only annihilate a people, but destroy their language.
Which brings to importance your translations in Reversible Monuments, book of contemporary Mexican poetry. It's not all Spanish.
No, it's not all Spanish. There are native languages in Mexico as well, and it's wonderful to have a few poets still writing in those languages, as well as people who can translate them into American English.
Yeah.
To give you a real vision of what the poetry of Mexico today is really like.
Yeah. Incredible anthology. I just got a copy recently, so I'm going to certainly delve
into
that. Other translations. I heard John Balaban read in Taos, New Mexico, Spring Essence, a book of translations. Amazing work.
By the great Vietnamese woman poet Ho Chuan Hong. That's a marvelous book, and one of the great things about that book is that it's trilingual. That is, it's in American English and in anglicized Vietnamese. And in the old Vietnamese language, which owes a great deal to Chinese written characters, but are somehow slightly different. So that book's really a trilingual book.
Yeah, an amazing
if work. One wants to really learn something about the Vietnamese language as well as Vietnamese poetry, you can go to that book where there basically is no other book.
You said while introducing Youssef Komunyakaa Saturday night at the Writers Conference that you wanted to bring him to the Writers Conference for years. Tell us why.
Well, I just think he's one of the great original voices today in American poetry. And Youssef and I have a number of passions in common, including what I would call classical mid-century jazz and Delta blues. And I can hear all of that in his poetry. He's a wonderful, elegant reader and a brilliant writer and a very great teacher.
Yeah, and that's important, obviously, for the Writers' Conference, someone who not only can deliver a reading, who's got the credibility, but someone who can teach.
There are lots of good writers who are lousy teachers. Just because someone writes well doesn't mean that so-and-so is a good guy or a smart teacher. So it's a unique combination of talents that we're trying to find.
Yeah. How much do you like teaching?
I don't teach anymore. I quit teaching about 10 years ago. I kind of burned out. I taught in the prison system for 14 years. And I spent a lot of years working with battered women and children. And I just kind of burned out on it, so I don't teach anymore.
Yeah, yeah. You also brought another poem, too, at least one more of your own. That would be nice to read.
Well, this is a little different kind of poem. It's written in Japanese music and meant to be played with my shakuhachi-playing friend, a Japanese bamboo flute player. So it's written, as the Japanese say, in fives and sevens. It's called The Orchid Flower. Just as I wonder whether it's going to die, the orchid blossoms, and I can't explain why it moves my heart, why such pleasure comes from one small bud on a long spindly stem, one blood-red gold flower opening at midsummer, tiny, perfect in its hour. Even to a white-haired craggy poet, it's purely erotic, pistil and stamen, pollen, dew of the world, a spoonful of earth and water. Erotic because there's death at the heart of birth, drama in those old sunrise prisms and wet cedar boughs, deepest mystery in washing evening dishes or teasing my wife, who grows, yes, more beautiful because one of us will die.
It reminds me of some of the later poems of William Carlos Williams.
Well, thank you. That's very nice.
Williams, yeah, something I wanted to bring up. He said that there is no poetry of distinction without formal invention. How important is it for Copper Canyon to push the art forward?
Well, I don't know that it's terribly important for Copper Canyon to be thinking in exactly the terms Williams put forth. I think it's more important for the poet to think in those terms. I've never considered myself an avant-gardist. In fact, in some ways, I've always thought of myself more as a kind of neoclassicist. But that doesn't mean that we're not in search of the perpetually new. I think every poem seeks to reveal something new and original, although nothing is self-originating, we Buddhists believe. So there's a tricky little combination that we're trying to achieve between what is not merely new on the page, but new in sound and fresh in vision and new in what it resonates with, new in finding a new tradition. All poetry, all art has to arise out of a tradition. Nothing is self-originating. So there's a combination there of bringing in the traditions of poetry and presenting something new at the same time. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah. It's the role of the poet to push the art forward.
And absolutely.
But it's your role to pick what poets are on Copper Canyon. So.
It's my job to pick what poets are right for Copper Canyon, but there are a lot of very good poets that aren't right for Copper Canyon for one reason or another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, who would be an example of someone like that?
Who would not be?
Who is you respect their work, but you don't see them as right for
Well,
Copper
I
Canyon.
Love Richard Wilbur's work, but I don't think I would be the best publisher for Richard Wilbur. He's really a formalist, and I'm not a big fan of formalism, although Hayden Carruth writes a formal poem as well as anybody in our language. It has to do maybe a little bit with the sensibility, but I read Richard Wilbur, and I admire his work greatly.
Yeah. Is there an avant-garde anymore?
Well, sure. I think Jory Graham is a kind of avant-garde. Frankly, I don't think her poetry has a lot of poetry in it. I think it's mostly prose broken up on the page.
Wasn't that what Williams said?
Editor's opinion, I want to make this clear. My opinion's very subjective. They have to be. And part of what makes art engaging is the dialogue that happens when we begin to disagree. And you become a fan of what I'm sort of putting down, or I become a fan of what you're putting down. And we learn to look at this stuff from a slightly different perspective.
We begin to look for the commonalities?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Which makes the translation so important.
Well, I think that's true in all art. You know, when people first heard Charlie Parker, they didn't know how to listen to it. And there was this enormous rush of notes, so many notes, you were just totally overwhelmed. It took us years, most of us, to learn how to listen to that stuff. We're still at a stage in this country where a lot of people never got past poetry in elementary school, and they say, well, if it's poetry, why doesn't it rhyme? Rhyme is only one of 100 tools. So it has to do with rhythm and measure and juxtaposition and image making.
Perhaps the most important thing about poetry, as they say in Taos at the Poetry Circus, poetry saves lives.
Well, I've always believed that. I've always claimed that poetry kept me from self-destructing when I was a teenager and strung out on heroin and obsessed with being the hippest teenager that ever lived.
Did you achieve that?
No, I almost self-destructed. But my friend Kenneth Rexroth kind of convinced me that poetry, in fact, could be a path to enlightenment. And I've been following a Zen path in poetry now for more than 40 years.
Here now, Sam Hamill reading from his CD, Heart of Bamboo.
Two yearling deer stood in heavy falling mist in the middle of the road leading into town, brown coats glistening, huge eyes open wide, caught in the headlights, in the first yellowish smear of coming daybreak. Twenty feet away, I finally stopped the car and sat still inside, eyes locked together in a curious searching with those of the doe. Minute by minute, we were transfixed, motionless, each imagining the other. And then the sun peeled back the dark clouds like a second skin. And in unison, the deer stepped slowly forward, gently, cautiously, off the road into underbrush that flourishes along the wood's edge, and vanished in mist. Dazed, I return to my day, to the work at hand. And now, the hour late in the morning, mist falling again. I can still feel my skin prickle under those beautiful brown doe eyes, touching me like a lover's hand, cautious, slowly exploring something deep in me I cannot touch or name.
CopperCanyonPress.org, the website.
Well, it's there, just like all the other ORGs. If you go to our website, you'll see a lot of poetry. You get information on books and broadsides and things that our writers are doing.
Yeah. Thanks for being on the program. Continued success.
It's my pleasure.
More with Sam Hamill in a moment, the founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference, poet, translator, and essayist. He's published over a dozen volumes of original poetry, including Destination Zero, poems 1970 to 1995, Gratitude, and Dumb Luck. Again, the website, www.coppercanyonpress.org. And if you didn't get that down, we'll have it on our website at inpeoria.org. That's I-N-P-E-O-R-I-A.org.